This is Sonic Ventures, a podcast celebrating the concept album format with Robert Goebel and Joel Tibbetts.
Sonic Ventures is an evolving series of discussions that explore concept albums from a variety of artists and genres. Our intent here is to have celebratory conversations of our personal experiences with selected works and the issues and themes surrounding concept albums.
Sometimes, we will be treading familiar waters concerning music interpretation and creation. Other times, we will venture into different places of thought, emotion, and expression. We invite you to join us on our Sonic Venture.
Hey everyone, Rob here, and welcome to Sonic Ventures Podcast Season 2, Episode 4. This episode discussion took place on Friday, March 19th, 2023, when Joel and I sat down to discuss one of hip-hop's first concept albums, Deltron 3030 by Deltron 3030. As with any discussion, this one has its natural rhythms and flow. Topics and ideas materialize and unfold as we travel through the exchange. Now, as we've stated before, we do not work with any predetermined outline. The conversations are completely unscripted and capture the first time we allow ourselves to discuss the album and music at hand. There are not only doors and corridors here, but windows too. Windows that offer a peek into our own experience with the music, but also into our lives and our friendship. We share this with you so you can venture through the process and the music with us. Now in that regard, please feel free to reach out and share your thoughts and comments with Joel and I. We can be reached at sonicventurespodcast@gmail.com, and you can find more information about us or the podcast at our website, sonicventurespodcast.com, or our Patreon account, where we post bonus content, including aftercast discussions with every episode. We've also got a social media presence on Instagram and Twitter. I'm sure you'll be able to find those. We'd be happy to hear from you. Though Deltron 3030 is both multicultural and multinational, one of the most exciting elements about it that I found myself most engaged by as I listened was the idea of Afrofuturism. It's just one of those doors in the discussion that we opened and left ajar. Now there are many doors like this in all our conversations. Doors to corridors and connecting rooms, a whole labyrinth of possibilities. Afrofuturism exists as a discourse unto itself and could easily be the subject of a whole podcast series, yet we only briefly touched on it. That's a pretty exciting door to leave open. Maybe it's a door one of you might find yourselves inspired to explore. Now for Joel and I, the conversation continues. Long after the episodes are wrapped and posted, that continued engagement we have with each other, the music, and what was brought up in the podcast discussion are part of the process for us, as much so as the episodes. These conversations are just a beginning, not an ending. They're part of something we affectionately call living a musical life. You, our audience, are part of that too. We hope you enjoy this one as much as we did, and that Deltron 3030 finds its way into your musical life as it did ours. Thanks so much for your continued support. Now here's the podcast.
We're rolling.
Yum, yum.
So, Rob.
Hey, Joel.
So nice to speak with you again.
Yeah, great to see you.
Today we're talking about Deltron 3030 by Deltron 3030.
Yeah.
Before we get into the discussion,
sure.
We talked about how we wanted to give a nice big thanks to our good friend Josh, who recommended this album to me, and I introduced it to you about over a year ago.
Yeah.
So we talked about how it'd be great to just acknowledge that, thank him for bringing it our way, and to also make up for something that we hadn't done earlier, which is to thank him as well for the artwork that he added to our logo picture for our podcast. There's a there's a picture of an album, and then in the middle there's this very colorful, vivid mandala. Josh designed that, so thank you, Josh,
for absolutely both those things. Yeah, thank you very much. And you know, Josh has been a great friend of the podcast.
Yes,
a supporter of yours and a friend of yours, and a creative partner in some music projects you're involved in as well. And we're lucky enough to have him be supportive and as a patron on our Patreon account. So, very much thanks to Josh. And Josh is one of those listeners that you imagine that we're also talking to, you know, when we're having our conversations. You know, there's sort of, if we had to imagine an audience, Josh is kind of that person to me. You know, someone that I don't know personally, that I've not met, but I feel that in some way I got to live up to his expectation and you know, be held accountable to a certain standard. So you know, Josh has many functions within our podcast, and some that I projected from my own mind just specifically. Very grateful for his support and suggestions, and he's given us some feedback over time that's been invaluable, I think, and also very encouraging. And
Very much so.
You know, as someone who's also involved in the creative arts and in music, it's you know, it's great to have that. So thank you very much, Josh.
Yeah, and just as an aside, Josh was also helpful for me on a couple questions I had related to this specific album, because he's got a much larger relation, a much broader relationship with hip hop than I do. And he's actually guided me to some really interesting things over the last few years. So thanks, Josh.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
So Deltron 3030, like we said, came into my awareness a year, maybe just over a year ago. And my first listening to this album was then. And I wanted to start off by saying that I listened to it once, loved it, and then decided not to listen to it again until we do it on the podcast. So I was just waiting, chomping at the bit to actually dive into this album for just over a year now. And for you, when was the first time you heard this album?
Well, similarly, you suggested it as a suggestion from Josh, as in, hey, check this out. What, you know, what do you think? And I did what you did, is I put it on and started to listen. And I heard enough in sort of the immediate sort of response in myself that, oh yeah, this is definitely something to contend with, and would be something that I'd want to get to know more. So it immediately made that shortlist position in, we'll call it, our hip hop category.
Yeah.
Because I know, as we've looked at genres and categories, you know, we sort of threw in shortlists, but our, you know, in any particular genre, we're limited by our own sort of experience and exposure to things. So, you know, in some genres, we are sparse in terms of even our knowledge of what would be appropriate or possible to do. And so, you know, certainly it made that list, but you probably could have initially given us any hip hop album and I would have put it on the list, because that would have been the next one I knew. Because to be fair, I don't have an enormous background or exposure to hip hop as a consumer, although listening to this album and also doing the research for this album, I realized I had much more than I thought I had.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I'm with you on to a certain degree. My relationship with hip hop is not as deep or as scholarly as some others. I've certainly had, over my lifetime, time periods where I spend a lot of time with it, and then I move to something else, and then a few years later I come back to it again. And I think part of the reason for that, for me anyways, is because there is, like all forms of music, there are things that I draw from as a composer There are things I draw from as a player of the instruments that I play. And then there's also just, I just like to listen to this. So I was also very excited to do this album because of just broadening my knowledge of not only hip hop, but anything else. Like when we do these albums, I always learn so much. And there's always a post-learning process after I have the conversation that, okay, now there's something else I have to look into because it came up or we talked about it. But I think with what first intrigued me about this album is that I didn't know it. I was surprised that it existed and it took this long. You know, it came out in 2000 and it took 20 years before I even knew about it.
Yeah, I'm probably very much in agreement with that sort of that perspective, because I similarly had that surprise in me. Mm. And as I was doing my research and refamiliarizing myself with what I knew and also what I wanted to or needed to know about hip hop, I was surprised in that process not to have encountered it in memory or even in the research process. I had to dig for it,
yeah,
and look for it, yeah, to find it. So if you threw on a documentary about hip hop, or you threw on that series that's on Netflix where they're episodically going through, I thought, oh, for sure this is going to be on there. It's going to be like three episodes with something, and I was quite surprised that I didn't find it so easily. Mm. And that's kind of interesting. I'm sure that, we'll talk about that as we get into the album, cause there's probably reasons, for it. But, I was super excited to know that it existed, mm-hmm, in this way, this fully developed, at that period in time. This album's from the year 2000.
Yeah.
So, it's not early hip hop in the sense that you could, but it's still early enough in the genre that that things were very exciting and they were still breaking new ground within their own genre.
Right. And this, I saw it often referred to as underground or indie hip hop.
Mm.
And I actually, when I was looking into this album, I did my best to find interviews or moments of conversation among the three. So you've got Del, the Funky Homo Sapien, Dan, yeah, the Automator, and then Kid Koala. Because I just wanted to get a little bit more sense of them with the music. And it was interesting for me to find that the whole thing about this album, like you said, that it doesn't seem to get a lot of attention, is that in one of these interviews with Dan and Del, the interviewer was talking about how he was seeing iterations of this album or this approach in later work of Jay-Z and Kanye.
Mm.
And I wasn't able to dig further into that. But I did find it really interesting for me to, as you said, it's not... I think if I was looking for this back in 2000 or maybe 2005, it would be much more difficult than now because of the resource we have of the internet and what's on there. But it is interesting to me as well how it doesn't get a lot of attention or it doesn't seem to. And I also feel that just my relationship with hip hop keeps me from really being able to say that with a greater certainty. But I did kind of ask a few friends who do have a lot of hip hop history, and they said they basically confirmed that. So I went along with that.
Yeah, and I think that caveat with a lot of the things that we'll probably say or bring up in the discussion is probably the spirit of the caveat is probably hovering over us the whole conversation, in the sense that things that we'll say or ideas that we'll have, we'll still have a certain limited historical, history for us. So, we're we're not trying to define or redefine hip hop by our perspective, or you know,
or
bringing some sort of assumed authority that we don't have.
Not.
You know, I mean, everything we do is always in the spirit of you know, two individuals going into things with curiosity. Mm-hmm. and a real interest and just sort of following the currents and threads through it and you know, bringing our own perspectives and selves and our own histories into that and kind of bringing it into some sort of meta narrative, you know.
And I think that along with that is just entering into the spirit of the unknown of this conversation,
which we have no idea.
We had to have a brief check-in at one point. But
yeah.
We kept the edict, which is we don't talk about the album before.
Yeah.
So I'm so interested to hear what you have to say about this album. So, and I feel like there's a million places to start.
And that's
why I want to kind of just dump it in your lap.
I thought I was going to be able to coast on this one. I'll get Joel talking, and then I'll sit back in the pocket.
Well, that's probably still possible.
Yeah, and I'll just punctuate as he moves through.
So, well then, okay, I am going to drop it in your lap.
Yeah.
So when you first started listening to the album, not a year ago, but to get ready for this conversation,
yeah.
Like, what came up for you first with it, in any regard?
The, you know, right away, I had to wrestle with form.
Okay.
I needed to get my head around what's going on here. What are the tools or what are the elements that I'm actually hearing?
Right.
How can I conceptualize this and tell it to myself in a way that I understand what I'm talking about.
Okay, that's fair.
And so I was struck by the word collage. It came up in my mind a lot.
Yeah.
I was struck by the artistry of collage and how the music was assembled by the automator.
Yes.
And of course that brought in ideas of cut-ups and different ways collage and cut-ups have been used creatively in the past. It brought up ideas of found art and different sort of conceptual art movement things where existing things have been repurposed or reassembled to be used as a new product. So I work to understand how this album was made. That was my first real mission. It's like, what was done? Who did it?
Yeah.
How did it come together? How is it a thing?
Yeah.
And how is it that I'm now listening to this thing? And so sort of developing and answering that sort of narrative for myself then helped me process it as it was playing.
Right. So you played the role of a sonic physicist.
In a sonic physicist and then an engineer and producer,
right.
I had to really sort of break out those roles and really understand, you know, just what is this that I'm listening to? Because, you know, you throw it on and, you know, to my naked ears, you don't know. Right. You don't know, is someone playing these instruments? Did someone write this song? Like, is this piece coming, you know, from, you know, some other song? Some obviously there's, you know, all those, some of those are obvious yes answers, but then beg the question to go and find out where they come from. But you just don't know, right, until you sort of break, you almost
educate
need
yourself. Yeah,
there's a Rosetta Stone
to
understanding this and to sort of inform your ability to listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really what I had to do when I first got into it and really get an appreciation for, you know, what these three guys were and who did what and when and how.
Yeah.
And what is the what, you know, really.
Yeah.
What I found really interesting, though I was able to kind of answer that for myself,
fairly quickly. And the need to do it was definitely part of the, you know, the necessity of listening.
Mm-hmm.
That process of understanding it continued through the whole mm-hmm. of my listening
right.
sort of journey with it. So mm-hmm. it wasn't a one and done kind of exploration answer question.
Right.
It's one that it just sort of grew and continued to grow as I listened and developed different mm. appreciations for what I was hearing.
Yeah.
So it's almost like part of understanding how it was put together and seeing, you know, if it, as an analogy, it's almost like you're seeing the tape splices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And understanding where things are joined and how they're joined gives you a much better ability to sort of internalize this for really what it is. Like that's part of the artistry of this, that you're meant to see those tape splices. Like you're meant to see it as an assembled product in that way. Right.
Yeah.
And so the deeper you get familiar with that and the more your ear gets tuned into it, you realize that there's way more of those than you thought. And mm-hmm. the, you know, it's like the amount of Lego pieces was way more, you know, like on the figure.
Right.
If the song was a Lego statue, it's like, oh, there's a lot more pieces here than I thought. So it was, you know, that really though was my first, real sort of, need with this.
Right.
And, you know, I think we joked a little earlier before the mic turned on about producers with Beyonce and you know, the role, you know, what is the role of the producer?
Yeah.
You know, what is a producer?
Yeah.
You know, with it's, this album, who's the guy? Is there a guy?
Yeah.
Who's the guy? Because we both come from traditional bands,
right?
In terms of our history of growing up through music. So I always carry a prejudice of band as creative unit.
Right.
Into sort of what I'm tuned to listen for naturally in music, to the point where that I could easily see that being a barrier to mm. listening to, especially my first exposure to the use of samples.
Right.
They just seemed to me, well, why doesn't somebody just play that?
Right.
Was my, you know, that was the kind of, my early hip hop exposure was
like earlier in your life.
Earlier in my life was sort of like, you know, like how about you just write that riff instead of taking the riff from there,
right?
You know, I have much different thoughts on that today, but you know, that was my early prejudice coming into this. So, but still, the question of who did what is a big part of, you know, understanding what it is I'm listening to,
right?
So. I don't know if that answers the
well. It's a good. Question. I think it's a good place to start,
right?
Because we're always talking really from our personal experiences of listening to the album. Mm. I think it's really interesting what you're saying about that, because I did the same thing. You talked about our backgrounds of being in bands, and that's true for me. But I also have a very early relationship with recording ambient sounds. Like when I was about 6 or 7 years old, my dad gave me a portable tape recorder, and I immediately started making my own radio shows and recording sounds and playing them back. And so when hip hop came into my awareness, I didn't really go there in terms of why don't you just play it, but I understand the thinking, because I think there's been moments with music that has used samples in a couple of other different genres of music where I have thought similar things. But I think that the thing that I wanted to get inside of what you're talking about is the ear for this kind of musical expression. Hmm. There's an incredible craft to choosing what to sample, how to work with it, how to mix it with other samples, and then create a new unified whole. So one way that I like to think about just the the mixture of the idea of using sampling and using beats and then mixing all of these materials together is you're basically creating a new ecology out of other ecologies. So I've always thought it's amazing how if you sample, you take a sample of, let's say, just a drum beat, you're not only using the beat, you're using the time and the moment that happened in that recording. And so to one thing that I did with this is I, fortunately, there is some listings of the samples that they use, and I went and checked them out and listened to them a number of times and then listened to the track that they were used on and really just brought in my ears and my engineering sensibility as to how did they EQ this? How did they weigh it with the other stuff that's there? And what I was looking at was, looking at who did what, but also where did the ears go to choose these things and how were they measured and balanced to create these tracks? And this is something I've actually done a number of times in the past when I've gone into hip hop dives, is just to hear, like, I've done, like, in another vein, Prodigy. Mm-hmm. Like how Prodigy creates, I can't remember the name of the guy who creates the music, but largely creates the music, is just how you take something and then you repurpose it. Is an incredible craft unto its own. And for me, I'm also drawing from my educational background, which was in electroacoustic, and how very early on in that too, I was working with, and I still do now, I work with samples, and there are many different ways to do it. But I think that, like you, I was so moved by this album that I wanted to get into how it was done. So for me, that was the equivalent to hearing a guitar part I like and then working it out and learning how to play it.
Yeah, and I'm with you there. But it wasn't the end of that process of getting into the sound. It was really the beginning.
Yes.
And then, sure, you know, once I had an ear for that or a sense of that, I could actually, you know, leave it behind as sort of an answered question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And go on to get more of an appreciation of each song or the album as a whole. Mm. And as you do that research, you do, you know, there's that one excellent website that actually has the samples compared to what was used in the song that you can play side by side, and they have everything sort of time stamped and bookmarked. Yeah. And yeah, very, very interesting to do that. There's a lot of folks that listen to this music and that's the whole point for them. Like, they love to deep dive on all the nerd out on all those sort of assembly items, and their appreciation of the music seems to be really focused on sort of those references, basically those little data points, which is great. You know, once I'd answered that for myself, though, I didn't need to know where every sample came from.
No. I get what you're saying. It's kind of like getting a tour of the orchestra.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of just listening to it and then leaving it at that, you want to know, okay, how many strings are really in here?
Right.
And okay, the brass did that. Yeah. So
yeah.
I get what you're saying. And so as you went on listening to this album, then, so where did it take you, and what was your experience of it?
So that's, that's a huge, super broad question.
I know.
my first approach to this, maybe a parallel approach, was basically through Sun Ra.
Right.
So I had the question of how is this a thing that I'm listening to? But equally, I dove into free jazz and Afrofuturism with Sun Ra to try and sort of develop more of a contextual understanding for where this existed sort of philosophically, mm-hmm. and what its sociological arc was, or its musical historical arc was. So, so I got very engaged in the beginning with listening to not this album, just listening to Sun Ra and listening to a lot of sort of Afrofuturist sort of music, but also writings and reading essays and looking again for interviews and conversations where that topic was discussed, and hoping to catch references to this album. Surprised again, not as much as I thought I would find, but most likely related to my own Google inability, you know, to find it. I'm sure there's tons of stuff out there, but you know, we've only got so long.
And, yeah, that's the other piece.
You know, and so much effort to to be able to find, you know, the different pathways through all this stuff. But yeah, so I was very engaged by that initial element of how Afrofuturism was in many ways the heart of this, the effect of this at the same time, like sort of, and just it gave a sense of gravitas and purpose to how I heard the narrative, and I explored a lot of sort of nerd rock and Afro nerdism through this, touching on the underground or outsider in sort of element of this, and how it connects into that subculture, particularly that Black subculture, I thought was really interesting. And so just developing a real appreciation for what that narrative through line was within the whole album. So that was my also my early sort of thing to hold on to. And I definitely appreciated that through the body of it. And it also was what I sort of use sort of to judge the effectiveness sometimes of some of the story, but also part of how I embrace the poetic of the narrative. So I didn't hold it to a specificity in terms of its, it didn't need to line up.
Right. It could stand on its own.
Yeah, it could stand on its own, and it could just be poetic too. So, like, you know, there's some absurdism as part of this. There's some surrealism as part of this. Yeah. You know, like, there's
tons of it.
There's so much. Yeah. I mean, there was so much in there. So, again, a broad question you asked.
It is a broad question, and the reason why I think I'm giving those broad strokes is because I felt like this album really reflected the cover in many ways. It's such a, there's so much in it that it almost has no standalone sides or edges. It's just this even contour for me when I was listening to it.
Right.
So,
And listening for both of us, neither of us had the vinyl for this, neither of us had the CD. So I think we were both streaming through our...
My main one was Apple.
Yeah.
And I didn't listen to the remixes.
Right, the bonus tracks.
I listened to the original album. And I think that the reason why I asked you that question so broadly is because, not only because... for me, there's just so many ways to talk about this album. But I think it's also because of it's being in the context of where we're placing it in the podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, it now comes into the thread, the line that's moving through this season where we, you know, the albums that we've done. And so what I've found is that every time we do a new album, that last album or some other album we've done kind of shows up in the new one that I'm listening to, right? So when I was listening to this, I was thinking about Dark Side of the Moon. I was thinking about A Love Supreme. I was thinking about Hounds of Love as well a little bit. But while what struck me about this album was how, the best word I can think of right now is that it had me the whole way through. Except for one particular track where I just kind of pull back a little bit. It's Turbulence.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one track where I like it, but it doesn't have the glow I found in all the other tracks. Now, when I say glow, I'm not saying that in terms of deifying any of it.
Sure.
It's just that there's Dan the Automator has proven time and time again that he not only, for me, that not only can he pick a beat, but he is so cinematic, so picturesque with how he builds the soundscape of tracks and what he does there, that all these tracks really, really work for me. And for those of you who haven't heard it, it's really quite wonderful because there's not only tracks with rapping on it, but there's also these amazing little short interludes that give you textures of the world that they're building.
Right. And I definitely want to get to those and get to that. I think it would be maybe helpful to just sort of discuss what we're talking about when we're talking about samples. And because growing up, samples were limited by technology and by memory of your device to sample. So your samples were arbitrarily short because that was the limitation of the 8-bit or whatever the megahertz value of your memory chip was at the time. You could only digitally capture so much of a song. Right.
Yeah.
So a lot of us that grew up with when we first heard the word samples, we heard like infinitesimally. Oh gosh.
Very small.
Very small. Thank you, Joel. Yeah, we heard really small snippets, little sound bites of songs. And so we were sort of learned samples to be these short little punctuations, really, within songs. Mm. Simultaneously to that, and a lot of us that didn't grow up with hip-hop awareness of how hip-hop was being created, where people were isolating drum breaks and grooves on vinyl albums, and literally the art of working your turntable was to be sort of overlapping and spinning these drum breaks in perpetuity to allow MCs and rappers to sing or rap over these sort of moments, these captured moments on existing vinyl. And as the genre sort of grew through and matured through that, it wasn't just drum beats that were used. There were other sounds that they similarly used to capture and punctuate. And that's, again, the art of the DJ or the mix master, depending upon how what you call him, would be bringing those elements in, sort of live turntable usage. And of course, as samplers and memory of sampling devices got larger, you could work with larger and larger sections and pieces and things. And when you got to speed things up and slow things down and, mm-hmm. and change pitches, people started to use the samples, not just as little elements of punctuation or little elements of reference in a song. They begin to build songs sort of cut and paste style using blocks of other songs and mm-hmm. things. And so when this album in particular mm-hmm. is sort of, the songs are crafted by cutting up huge blocks yeah. of multiple songs.
Yes.
And assembling them together, collage style, which yeah. is that was the reference in what I said earlier, sort of this sort of cut and paste and bonding together and creating these sort of as that's Dan the Automator, the mm-hmm. producer who's putting the bed tracks together mm-hmm. and sort of developing the narrative through just the structural creation of all these samples and manipulation of them into a song. Mm-hmm. And Koala and
Del.
It's like, I got a pull down list of what do I want to call him? Because he's got 14 nicknames, you know? Yeah. Del is, you know, they all have their roles in that. But everything starts really with the sort of project impresario is Dan the Automator, right? In terms of bringing those beds together.
And I also was able to find an interview with Dan and Del talking about how there was also a lot of back and forth.
Hmm.
So sometimes it would be like where Dan, as from what I gained from this interview, was that he would lay something down and then Del would throw something on it. But there was also, they also talked a little bit about how there was a back and forth.
Right, so it wasn't Dan going, I've done my part, now exactly. you go do
so
you.
There was moments or periods of time where there would be a back and forth. Although I did read that Del wrote the lyrics in 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
which is extremely interesting considering how many words there are on this album.
There are a lot of words on this album, yeah. A lot of words. I think both Joelle and I, both of us, we had the experience of, we like to collect the lyrics as part of our study and print them off and probably carry them around with us as we listen for reference. And at some point, that just wasn't working. There were just too many.
Yeah.
Too many.
And so for me, when I was listening to this album, like you're talking about that collage piece, I also, and then figuring out, you know, how things are put together. You're right about the, you know, the length of samples. I mean, the term sampling has, it's like talking about a particle. They're not talking about particles. That's just the word that was affixed to it early on.
Right.
It's just the idea of using something that has already had a life and repurposing it. So you can have very long, you can have sample, you could sample, there's no limit to how long you could sample something. You could basically say a sample is a recording.
Right.
But at the same time, if you look at something like granular synthesis, the opposite has happened where you can go really, really small and make it really, really big. So you're right. There's a use of sampling in this album that is broader than the history of sampling.
Yeah. And the talent of embracing this almost like totality of the songs are created almost entirely out of these samples, right? Like the actual
to a certain degree. Yeah. And I think there's also, I know for me that I hit a number of walls of how did they do that? Because there is also something about how maybe a bass part was put in there or maybe how a tempo was changed.
Yeah, and pitches were melded.
But I think I also hit a wall of really understanding, because honestly, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall just to see how they all put it together. That's my idea.
Yeah.
Well, the process, but also just what is actually in here. Because what I found is that when I listened to it day after day after day, I loved it. And then I took a break And I think it's a week where I stopped listening to it. And the moment I put it back on, there was all this other stuff that I hadn't heard before.
Completely fresh ear experience. Yeah.
And it was, it was really, it just put me into another place of, I don't actually know how all of this was done, because in a sense, because of just that, that second listen and hearing new things stick out. But the other thing I did when I was listening to this album is I listened to the instrumental album of this album.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I took the time to just listen to the bed tracks without the rapping on it to maybe get inside it a little bit more.
Was the scratching on it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just the
there was just no Del. The there was no, because Del sampled, he's sampled in it a bit, but there was none of his lyrical rapping on it. And part of the reason why I did that is because as I approached this album, I looked at how everything works together and then how the rapping works on its own and then how the tracks function on their own.
Yeah.
And I've always enjoyed Del's rapping. I mean, I was introduced to him through the Gorillaz, which maybe a lot of people were.
Yeah.
And I've always enjoyed his rhythmic vocabulary. And I've listened to a number of his albums over the years here and there. And I took the time to listen to some other stuff he's done. And I just felt like there was an impetus in his rapping on this that I didn't hear in anything else. I did, and it's not to say that it's not him rapping in these other things, but there's just this like intensity and skill of how he's using the words and how he's rhythmically placing them and the poeticism he's using and how I love, it was almost like he took every single thing that's ever been written in sci-fi and put it in a cauldron and heated it up a little bit. And then he dipped his fingers in it and then pulled out all these different references. I mean, there's the movie, The Black Hole, there's Battlestar Galactica, there's Dune, there's Planet Fantastique. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in here, and how he can use all of these references and then retool them to create his own physics.
Right.
To move meaning, but then to spin meaning. Like there's so many, I feel like we could spend hours just talking about, well, what does this line mean?
Yeah.
There's this a beautiful directness, but also openness I found in his choices. But his rhythmic vocabulary in this to me made me think of something like bebop.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the beat, but then the way he...
Yeah,
I don't mean to take you too far into your past, but he accordions tempo is really, that really stands out for me, is how he can push the beat, move the beat back, he can relax, he can drive things forward, and he can turn phrases where, like sometimes I would hear his lines and I would have to choose not to listen to them because then I can't listen to the everything else he's saying. There's just so much coming out.
Well, that's probably one of the biggest challenges with listening to this is that, and a question of how do you listen to this? I mean, we could spend, and we may touch on this in another discussion at another time when to talk about listening, but if it, you know, when you sit down to listen to this album, if you're trying to follow the lyric through, as a listener, if that's your main grab aurally in this song, you get detached from it, you are lost from it, gets ahead of you in your ability to process it very quickly, right? So, you know, you can't keep up in real time as a casual listener to what's being said, and you know, with any degree of precision. You know.
Well, and what I also liked about the experience of this album, which I noticed I did more than any other rap album I've ever listened to, was I just listened to the rhythmic vocabulary.
Right.
Like I can remember da 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 da.
Yeah,
da,
you
da 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 da. Like I remember the rhythms without the words.
And that you know, in a lot of rap, that's actually the more important part, right? Mm. That, you know, the flow of the rap. Mm-hmm. There's some rap terms here to do with flow and things that yeah. they actually sort of quantify and you know, that's your equivalent of iambic pentameter, right?
Yes.
Right.
But like you were saying, but it's, you can't really digest it.
No.
You have to, you have to place your attention very mindfully to be with it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the other things that I loved about this album is that it was like, I could choose the phase of engagement that I was in. Am I in the beat more?
Yeah.
Am I more in the rapping? Am I in the soundscapes that are being made?
Where am I hearing? What am I engaged with at that moment? Because you can listen to this album, and even if you're focusing on the lyrics, not hear a word and register a word. If you can just listen to the flow, just to the punctuation, to the melody.
Yes.
Of the rap itself, right? You know, you may invariably a word or a phrase jumps out, you know, as even if you're trying to suppress it, like, so you can't like entirely not hear words, but no. you can kind of change your focus. Mm-hmm. And you're right. You can listen to the soundscapes, you can listen to the samples themselves and just focus in on what you think the automator has done or is doing.
Yeah.
You've got this incredible scratching going on,
which is really great.
Which to me is the human element of this album.
Interesting.
Because it's the only instrument being played on the album and by a guy who's physically playing it.
If we take Del's voice out of the picture.
If we take Del's voice out of the picture.
Yeah. I think you're right about that, but I'm not actually 100%. Well, I mean, if I look at the credits, that's true.
Yeah.
But then there's also Damon Albarn. He plays melodica.
Yeah.
He's also listed for additional instruments.
Yeah. They're more... We'll call it snippets and stuff. Whereas, like, if you had to like trace a voice through this outside of Del,
okay,
it is Koala playing, okay. You know, playing and scratching as a melodic instrument mm-hmm. and so it's the of course there's melodic instruments on the samples, but the samples are one or two generations removed from the guy who did the actual,
right?
You know, thing. And so when I say Koala is the only one, you know, human touch, he's the closest to first gen human touch consistent through the album in his role.
Yeah.
And so there's something very interesting, whereas Del is kind of locked into the rhythm of his vocal that he's established.
Right.
Koala is much freer in his sort of idiomatic approach to his own scratching that is much more like vocal scat singing. So he's scat singing, but through scratching in a way that to me is less locked into a meter like Del is more locked into. And I just found that really kind of a neat little contrast that the guy who you assume has a sort of a minor role on the album, or if you know, like if you brought that sort of like, well, what's scratching on this album? Like, well, how important is that? And you realize it's all over the place.
Yeah, it is.
And it's like, it's essential. It's not a asterisk. Got this guy scratching on it. Yeah. It's.
And so what you're saying has an interesting validity because you don't notice it so much. Right?
Yeah.
Like you can focus on it, but at the same time, it's not like we're scratching now.
No, it's like drums, bass, and guitar.
One track that I'm trying to remember right now, which one it's on. I think it's
when he plays the trumpet.
Maybe the trumpet Mastermind. Line. There's a long tail to the track where the beat carries on. Del's done. And then there's all this scratching, but the first few times I listened to it, I didn't really take it in.
Mm.
So I'm there with you on how integrated his role was in the album, which also brings me to this other interesting surprise, the Canadian content. Yeah. Like when you get to the middle of the album and there's an advertisement for Strange Brew.
Right.
Which is probably the most surreal part.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty special. Because you don't have to go too far from Strange Brew to find Rush. So, you know, this was essentially a Rush album. Yeah. Just with that one reference, it tied into the whole Rush catalog.
That's too far for me.
Is it?
Yes.
Not for me. It was right there. I found another Rush reference to the Body Electric. There's a lyric on here that where he talks about, and I'm forgetting the lyric. I'd have to look it up. But when he goes crack the mold instead of crack the code, right? Get in the Body Electric. I think it's at least crack the code. No,
yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah, the lyric anyway,
right now.
Grace Under Pressure.
I know the album. I just don't remember the
lyrics. Yeah, that's all right. So for me, I was,
I speculated that Kid Koala's hands were a little bit more further than just the turntables because the samples, a number of them are from Canadian artists that I didn't even know about.
Right.
Like now Placebo, and what was the other one? Bonnie Dixon, the Poppy Family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if Placebo was Canadian. No, Placebo isn't Canadian, but the Poppy Family is.
Yeah. And then there's also little snippets of dialogue and things.
Well, the St. Catherine Street.
Yeah.
That's got to be Montreal.
Well, I mean, it's the most famous St. Catherine Street in Canada. We probably have about 5 St. Catherine Streets
in Vancouver. 10.
Like, yeah.
They're in every city, but But the history of St. Catherine's.
Yes.
With what comes off in the samples and in the vocalizations in the track about prostitution. Yeah. And addiction, people trying to turn a trick here and there.
Right.
It kind of echoes at least what I heard, the history of St. Catharines was.
Well, both Joelle and I are French immersion alumni. I have my own St. Catharines Street story because on the 2 Quebec exchanges I went on as part of my school journey, one of them we did go down to St. Catharines Street. And I can't remember if it was the grade 7 visit or the grade 10 visit.
All I want to know is, did you go to a maple syrup farm or not?
We went to a maple syrup place and we did the whole syrup and the snow thing. But we also found ourselves carousing on St. Catherine Street, talking to prostitutes and trying to get into strip bars. So I guess it would have been grade 10.
So you really identified with elements of this album.
I really identified with elements of that album that it brought me back to this idea that because the drinking age in Quebec was 18, that we as 15-year-old grade 10ers, thought we had a chance.
I did. I thought I had a chance too, and I got the chance. So not a problem.
I failed at my chance. Well done, sir. But yeah, St. Catherine Street, the Bob and Doug reference is great. Quickly on those references, I mean, part of my reading and research, is that, hip hop itself has a tradition of this kind of vignette in some of their albums. Often they look at them as skits and the vernacular that they talk about. When they look at them, this kind of thing for some annoys some listeners. In terms of concept albums, this has a long and storied history.
Yes.
You go back to, The Small Faces and Ogden's Nut Gone Flake or whatever.
Yeah, I don't remember
that. A weird title like that. You've got The Who Sell Out, these commercial parodies and these sort of like threaded vignettes are a device that, as you said earlier in this conversation, they absolutely give context and depth and breadth.
Texture. I love the word.
Textures. Yeah. Texture is a great word because they, they're kind of on their own, they're kind of nonsensical,
right?
But somehow they give body and they give texture to a world. They help create this world in a very I don't want to say profound's not the word I'm looking for, but they really are a necessary element in this album to give sort of the scope and to thread these songs together. Like they don't disrupt the songs.
No.
They tie them together.
Yeah, they do. And the reason why I really appreciate them is because they present more questions than they answer. And I think that is just in general, in terms of whatever art form you're working in, is I think building an effective ecology creatively is not about perfection. It's very valuable to have messy pieces that just speak of something about whether it's directly related to what's going on in the story or not, it at least has some halo of it's possible to go down another road, but it didn't happen. So if I think about something like the St. Catherine Street track, you have all of these characters collaged together, and you start, at least for me, I started wondering more about what's their story, what do they look like, or how do they live their lives? And even though that doesn't have to do with Dell, and it doesn't have to do with the primary plot arc of the story, it enables you to feel that the life of where things are happening without having to define it.
It populates.
Yeah.
It populates this album, right? Mm-hmm. It also, for me, is one of the ways in which the fact that this is a dystopia is actually giving credulity, basically. Because although we love the Bob and Doug reference, the Bob and Doug reference is wrong in its sense that, hosers were not Renaissance men, you know, and Bob and Doug were not, you know, sage.
Well, they were zeros that were heroes.
Yeah, zeros that were heroes, which on the flip side is the theme of the album, right? It's part of that.
Yeah, that's a big piece of it. So the Bob and Doug reference, the way they're talked about.
Yeah, there's like you get to know like all the snippets mirror the way they themselves are sort of a mashup of samples and news clips and voices and narratives. And it mirrors the construction of the songs in the album themselves, but it makes the world match the songs. Like, because this, it's through those little cut-ups and these interludes that the world is established.
Right.
And so it's got this really interesting sort of like mirror overlay that they say they're different, but they're the same at the same time. But for me, that idea of dystopia, the fact that those things are odd in their assemblage, right? Yeah. Like they're not quite go together. As listeners, we've seen that. You know, we've seen that with Max Headroom.
Yeah.
Right, we've seen that in our own digital culture of how clips are being used and commercial clips like that are being used. And there's already a vocabulary of those that sort of suggest a coming dystopia.
Right.
This is part of the dystopian aesthetic. And not a dystopia that is apocalyptic, right? This isn't a post-apocalyptic society. This is just capitalism and our current trajectory of digital,
right, which is
sort of,
which is all dystopian does that is they're really they're talking about now, they're talking about the time they're written in,
right?
I many years ago went through a period of time of reading a lot of Russian science fiction during the USSR time,
Right.
Because I learned, well, first of all, it's connected to one of my favorite films, but I also learned that a lot of those writers were using sci-fi because they couldn't say what they wanted to. So they were able to cloak their intents in symbolism and imagery and relationships that seemed to be so far out of the context that they couldn't be accused of anything.
Yeah.
This, of course, is not that. No. Like, it's pretty straight up in many ways about what it's conveying.
Hmm.
But I think that what you're talking about makes me think about, like, the one thing I did want to talk about, of course, is the whole idea of dystopian narratives and their role for human beings and creative artists and that. And I think that, I think that yes, this album is reflecting what is going on in a number of ways. But what I also find really interesting along with that is because it's dystopian and because it's sci-fi, Del can give himself huge powers, but still they're not enough, right? He can have these mystical computer mech physics.
Well, he talks about the rap battle, but he's still kicked out, you know.
Yeah, but yeah. he can form a star.
Yeah,
but he can't really take down what he can't make the change that he wanted to make. So now we're moving into the story and we're moving into the plot and that. But just to go back to the dystopian piece is that it's always been interesting to me about how sci-fi reflects the time that it's written in. And yet at the same time, it's yearning towards or directing towards the future or some kind of concept of the future. And I feel like the lyrical content does an incredibly good job at not only conveying that approach, but also how you can weave in other things about what you're saying without being direct, if that makes any sense. Like I feel like there's so many layers that when we were talking about just listening to the lyrics, like there was one day I was on the train and I was listening to this album and there was one lyric in particular that I just like the absurdity of it. The line is asteroid surfing, castor oil burping. And yeah. I had to stop listening to it just to take the time to say, I love that line, but I don't know what it means.
And that's a great point. Like, and you don't have to know what it means because it doesn't necessarily mean anything. You know, and it doesn't carry the burden of needing to mean anything, right. which is important to be able to accept, to really embrace what's happening here. Because you know, some people will listen to, well, this is nonsense.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's not, you know, it's like, or the narrative doesn't exactly track, right? You know, like there's that kind of, but that's not what's happening here. You know, that this is part of the poetic, and just the formation of sounds and our association with words as feelings, right?
Yeah.
So words convey information, but they also convey feelings, right?
So yeah, you know, exactly. So me stopping in that moment
was to a take feeling.
To take in asteroid surfing, castor oil burping.
Yeah,
I started laughing because I thought it was so funny and wonderful and surreal.
Yeah,
but then I just loved the playfulness of the lyric. And you're right; it was I turned off the music so I could feel the lyric.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it was.
Yeah,
and there's other moments like that for sure.
And that's the gift of this album. Like, I mean, you know, it's not the burden of it, but the gift of it and all those words is that the more you listen, the opportunity for that kind of experience is not random, but it's still packed in there because there's so much, you know. Yeah. So your 100th listen might equally yield something that makes you feel something.
Well, even the idea that he begins as a mech warrior, and how, like, I got really interested in mech warriors, not because of what they were, but because of where they came from.
Hmm.
They came from samurai.
Right.
They came from the idea, like, it's right out of Japanese armor culture. It's a mech warrior. And so even the idea of the symbolism of him having this occupation as a mech warrior and then not being down with it.
Well, Afrofuturism is not all that different from Afrohistoricism, which is basically related to Afro samurai. That whole, and both of us love Japanese culture and love the samurai culture.
Some things about it.
Not
everything.
not the head losing at a drop of a hat.
But the draw that I made to it, and this is, I find this line of conversation really interesting, is because the first thing that I don't subscribe to with samurai ethics is that your life is in the service of something outside of you. And largely that thing is a leader, right? It's your retainer. Right. So him talking about a mech warrior, the first thing I thought about was that idea that he's been in a role of servitude. He's been serving this great, what was it? Global apartheid or post-apocalyptic world or cyber warlords or all the ways that he talks about, even in the beginning, the corporate institutional bank of time.
Right.
And so he's almost, for me, he was almost placing himself in a role of servitude.
Yeah. And then
pulling himself out of it.
I'm not going to disagree with that, but I would qualify that with not servitude to a master per se, but servitude to more like a corporate, and more specifically an economic. So I would almost look at these guys as like economic, like part Ronin, part mercenary. But
I don't think he becomes Ronin until he takes off.
You think that's the...
There's only two ways to become Ronin in samurai philosophy.
Right.
And the first way is that your master, your retainer is dead or something, or you actually choose to leave.
So
you're right, though. Like the piece about him serving something outside of himself is more drawn up in maybe what we would look at now, which is... larger corporate geopolitical entities,
but also confused. Sorry to interrupt, but confused entities. Like this is a dystopia, so these aren't obvious, perfectly aligned entities that people are. I think they're sort of things that are confused, cross allegiances, and that manifest in sort of emergent ways through the grander historiosity of the narrative. So that it's, although they've given some names and ridiculous titles to these nefarious overlords, they're not exactly competent and they're not really overlords, but they somehow wield still some sort of power, right? And that's got to be economic.
Well, in this interview I saw with Dan and Dell, they were talking about how they felt that what they were talking about has been going on forever. They didn't like it's always hard to watch an interview because you can't ask the questions you want.
Right. You can't redirect.
Yeah. You can't say, well, can you say more about that? But what the impression I got was that you're right. What we're presented with feels like now, but I think that some of what they were pointing at is more, has a larger arc than the present, right? It's been around. And that's why I think I would also say with samurai, I mean, back in feudal Japan, they were fighting over real estate.
Yeah.
That's, you know, who's got the most real estate, who has the most power. So whether that's about, the Japanese countryside or who owns how much of the internet, you're still talking about an ownership factor and then the scale of that and the influence of that. So the fact that he takes the skills that he has and repurposes them to take everything down, which you pointed out very, very well, I think, is that it's not like everything is one thing. Like, not everything is integrated and on the same page.
Right. There's, it's messy,
but he still wants to change things. Mm. And it's just so interesting how, to me, how it arises in a galactic rap battle. It's so interesting, and I just love the way how he depicted it. Like, it was so the drum beat that's in there, it's all on the ride, and it's very open, and he just goes and describes it in detail how he wins.
Oh yeah, and he's like, I mean, and there's carnage, you know, like there's carnage in the battle. So you know, the sound man is, you know, blowing up.
And just how, like I said before, how he takes sci-fi and physics and he uses it to create these powers and direct them in these ways. I was just so charmed by it. I thought it was so beautifully eloquent and playful and exciting.
Yeah.
And but then how in the arc of the story is that he wins the battle, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
Right? And the other thing about this album, a concept that carries through it that I really appreciated was it's sci-fi, but it's so much about memory. It's so much about where you've come from, what you've experienced, what you're going to do with that. And then also how once you've achieved something, where are you now? How do you reflect on yourself after you've achieved this supposed thing you've gone after?
Right.
And how, the other thing I want to talk to, but I don't know if we'll have enough time in the episode, is how they bookend the whole thing.
Yeah.
But the piece about really focusing on memory and sci-fi had me thinking about Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And it also had me thinking about one of my favorite films, Stalker. By Andrei Tarkovsky.
Okay.
And how there's this really interesting surrealism about memory. And just really quickly, a friend of mine when I was in university as a filmmaker, he made this film and the character was in prison. And there would be scenes of him in prison and then scenes of him doing flashbacks to his life before he was in prison. And in the film, when he's in prison, all of it's in black and white, but all the past is in color. And I remember him being asked, why did you choose black and white here and color there? And he said, because I think we always have a more colorful memory and we tend to have a much more black and white immediate experience of life. So when I was listening to this album and thinking about memory as a theme that was running through it, I felt that I was reflecting on this idea of things being monochrome, things being colorful.
Right.
And how by the end of the shape of this story and how he just kind of, it just kind of ends.
Mm-hmm.
And how it almost ends with a black and white feeling. It was very striking for me. I don't know if that really
explains it. I really like what you're saying there, and I think we'll talk a little more about that in the aftercast, which is the conversation that we record immediately following the podcast, ergo the aftercast, where we get we follow maybe more idiosyncratic pathways to deeper or maybe extraneous or parallel tracks through the same discussions. We opened it up a little more, but available usually through our Patreon account for Patreon subscribers. The idea of memory.
Mm.
What are samples but memories?
Thank you.
There we go.
Already got to the deep dive. Exactly.
And so. And there's so I think I know how we're going to dive through this later. I loved your film references. I too carried some film references here. particularly several French films by the if you're familiar with Delicatessen.
Oh yeah,
and the Jean-Pierre director
Genet.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I love that film.
And his other films. Mm. This has that. Even there are samples on this. I mean, the French yeah. composer is who's sampled quite a bit on this. Yeah. But there
William Scherer.
Yeah,
I think his name is.
I think you're correct there.
Yeah, and then Fantastic Planet,
yeah.
which is a French film.
There's sounds on this, the harmonium and that are French carnival, you know, like there's a European element yeah. to this. There's a bit of a gypsy element to this. This album feels very much like the video game Fallout New Vegas, right? You know, it's got that Fallout faded memory soundtrack sort of coming together. Very interesting.
I like that you're using the word soundtrack because this album, I'm sure that part of the hook that it got in me was that it has a cinematic aesthetic. And when you look at the other work that especially Dan, the Automator, and Kid Koala have done, they've done film music.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that this is a speculation on my part. But I feel that if you're someone who works with samples, you already have a cinematic bent. Like you already have a predilection for visualizing sound.
Mm.
And I'll use the word again, texturizing sound. And this album I found was so consistent for me with that.
Yeah.
Just kept me in. Scene after scene after scene. And to reference another episode of our podcast, I couldn't go and just listen to one of these tracks on its own. I was like, okay, I got to start at the beginning because I wanted the whole experience again.
Yeah.
And I'm finding as we do these episodes and we talk about these albums, that has kind of become it's not an evaluation of the album. But it's a quality that I recognize in myself when I listen to them, is if I listen to an isolated track, do I need to hear the whole album?
Mm-hmm.
And this one is definitely one of those.
Yeah. And you know, this is not a short album.
It's just over an hour.
Yeah. Although, is that with those bonus tracks tagged on the end?
It sits at an hour and 18 seconds without the bonus tracks.
Right, yeah. I ended up by doing a breakdown on that too, you're right. yeah, so, and again, for this, you know, I'm sure we'll be discussing this, you know, at some point in a future discussion, and we've already touched on it in the past, but, you know, albums were vinyl records, and, you know, with a vinyl, you had 30 to 40 minutes of sound. Right. And, yeah. and you had two sides that were part of a vinyl album initially. As we moved into CDs, album length suddenly, because the space was there, swelled, you know, which was great for it sometimes, and sometimes to an album's detriment. Yeah. And it made it in terms of the listening experience of albums by stretching out the time. This album on vinyl is actually four sides, right? Mm. So this is a double album.
Yeah.
To accommodate this, so if you look at the track order, you can sort of break this album up into each of its component sides, and it makes it a little more digestible as a way to navigate through it as a listener.
Mm.
So I found myself initially on the first listenings being quite overwhelmed by the length and the duration of it and needing to give it some sort of structure experience.
Just as an aside, I've learned this about you as we've gone through these albums. I mean, I think I'm not really sure how to qualify it or quantify it, and I'm not sure, and I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, But I'm learning something about you in terms of structure and listening. Because for me, I started listening to this and it went right through me like water. And so I'm very curious to learn more about this, about you, about how you approach listening and having structure.
Yeah, well,
this is certainly not a request for you to explain it.
No,
right
no,
now.
And I think it's. I think we'll definitely discuss that more. You know, there certainly is. You know, how you listen to these albums is related to their length. You know, you if an album's an hour long and you want to listen to an album, you got to have an hour. Right,
you know, there's a temporal condition.
There are some preconditions and conditions both. Yeah. You know, because you've got to prepare. Yeah. You know, so yeah, you can listen to songs on any concept album. You know, sort of pick and choose them. But the sort of decision to sit down and listen to an album, isn't just about am I going to pay attention. But it can be as basic as do I have the time?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that for me did come up in my listening of this album. Like there were times where I didn't have the time. I didn't have an hour.
Yeah. You know,
I had. You find the time. And so it works out.
Or it's make not, it.
You make it. Yeah. Yeah. But there definitely was a moment there that allowed me to kind of break this album up into its sides and try and mirror in my mind that sort of natural pause of like, you know, the intermission or turning the reel or flipping the album, you know, like it just.
Right. But this having come out in 2000 would have been on CD.
And vinyl.
Was like, it on, it, did it, they release yeah. it on vinyl too?
Yeah, it was a double album. Mm. So, and I always assume, although I could be assuming incorrectly, that hip-hop...
The nature of assuming often
yeah.
is...
Yeah. You're a philosopher, my friend.
Well, as my grandfather said, it makes an ass of you and me.
I first heard that on The Odd Couple.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was a famous skit where they go through that, and it was like... I was like 9 or something. It was like the funniest thing I ever saw. There's.
I'm sorry.
I don't remember what I was saying. No idea what we were talking about there.
Well, maybe it'll show up in the aftercast.
It just might
show up in the aftercast.
But you know, as I look at the time, we're getting close to the end here. Mm-hmm. Really. This was a really enjoyable album to listen to for me. And the experience of it, like you mentioned briefly at the beginning of the discussion, you know, there's a time period after these discussions and after the listens that we're still engaged with these works. And they you know, we either continue to pursue them, you know, as we follow our own new individual tangents away from the discussion. But it also helps us connect to the next one and to the past one. And we're kind of working that out. And so, you know, our time with this isn't over. And, you know, what we've been able to discuss here really is just the beginning of
well, not to mention
many
that
conversations.
There was a sequel to this. And there's news of there being a third album. So we'll probably do the second one at some point. But yes, I'm with you on that. I already have a listening list to get to after this.
Yeah.
There's about half a dozen albums that I'm just going to listen to and see how they feel. And there some of them are, well, work of Dan the Automator. Some of them are Kid Koala. Some of them are Adele. And then there's some of these sample bits. That I haven't really given the album a full listen, and I'm curious just to add that to my listening experience.
Right.
And I think that what you're saying about this post process that we have, I'm still doing it for Dark Side of the Moon, and it's interesting. I find it interesting how I have found this process of doing this podcast with you less like getting over hurdles, but actually just laying out more of them in front of me.
Yeah.
So I feel like every time we do an episode, there's a very, very brief feeling of accomplishment.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole other track.
I got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, exactly.
But and not a burden, not bad work. Like I can't wait to do this extra.
And largely what it is it's just listening to music.
Yeah.
And seeing what that brings. And I think that has been, I expected something of it, but I have been surprised by how opulent it is, you know? And I think it's not only just the very albums we talk about, but it's also the conversations we have.
Yeah. And I find myself bringing and referencing the albums that we've listened to in ongoing everyday conversations with people. Oh. Like I'm bringing...
Is that annoying for them?
Well, it might be. You know, I feel like I'm carrying under my arm, I'm compiling and carrying these albums with me, you know, like they're books and that I'm ready to pull out and kind of, you know.
There's a Grove Dictionary feeling to this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like yeah. I feel like for me, and I guess between us, we're building this kind of archive.
Yeah.
And it has its own relationships. It has its own dimensions. It has its own influences. And it's just really intriguing how, as we go along and add another album, which technically is more than an album, because like we end up listening to other things. Like you said, Sun Ra. I didn't listen to Sun Ra because I've listened to so much Sun Ra.
Mm-hmm.
But you talking about it now makes me think, oh, I got to listen to more Sun Ra.
I got to go back and do that.
Well, and also since just in the last few years, I mean, this is a little bit of a connect here, but, you know, Chick Corea, Wayne Shorter. Yeah. Pharrell Williams.
Yeah.
And so you just, yeah, like there's so much to listen to and it's worth making the time to do. But what I like what you just said is that you, in a way, you take our meditations and you take them out into the rest of your life.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is the key to me of learning and or meditation is that you, the thing itself, that's great, but it has to grow. It's better, I think, in my mind. Better? I don't know, maybe that's not the right word, but that it blossoms beyond itself and it finds itself in other parts of your life. So we've talked about it a number of times on this podcast and off mic about having a musical life.
Yeah.
And there's so many ways to do that.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's amazing. Like when, like for doing this album and when I started listening to it and started thinking about hip hop and that, I liked how I felt overwhelmed.
That's fantastic.
I loved it. I loved how I was thinking, there is so much about this that I don't know. But like you, I would find, okay, I know about this, or I understand this.
Yeah.
But it's like a lot of other forms of music, whether it's classical or Baroque or jazz or metal. There's just so much going on that I feel at times that whatever I'm doing with music in my life is somehow a part of the total celebration of music.
Yeah.
And so with you saying, like, even the way you did it, you can't see it, that you actually made the gesture with your hand, like you're holding a bunch of school books or something.
Yeah, like virtual, like the albums tucked under my arm, for sure.
Like to me, an engagement with someone to talk about music starts from that enjoyment of music.
Yeah.
And it ends on that enjoyment of music. And whatever happens in the middle is you might gain some things, you might find some new things, you might have a little bit of an argument, who knows. But to begin and end with that sense of just the full richness of music that I think all of us, whether we create it or we're listening to it, it's still a journey that we're all embarking on together.
Yeah.
It's quite beautiful.
Very well said.
Thank you.
Very well said. Thanks, Joel.
Thank you. This was a great conversation. And now I'm looking forward to the aftercast.
Yeah, me too.
Sweet.
Let's get into it.
Perfect.